Hello, this is Krista Farova. Welcome to another episode of the Strategy Skills Podcast. Our podcast sponsor today is strategytraining.com. If you want to strengthen your strategy skills, you can get the overall approach used in well-managed strategy studies. It is a free download. Go to firmsconsulting.com/overall approach. And if you are currently preparing for interviews and want to work on your resume, you can get McKinsey and BCG winning resume. It is a free download as well. Go to firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF. And today we are speaking with Guy Kawasaki. Guy will teach us some things about his last name. There is a story behind it. And Guy is a chief evangelist of Canva. All of us know Canva, love Canva, great platform for creators and professionals as well. He's author of a book called Think Remarkable, a very good name, and host of the Remarkable People podcast. He was the chief evangelist of Apple, Mercedes-Benz brand ambassador, and trustee of the Wikipedia Foundation. So welcome, guys. So great to have you with us
Thank
today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start with the story behind your last name.
Okay. It's not the story behind my last name, but it is something that has happened to me dozens of times. Well, in the pre-recording stage, you asked how to pronounce my name, and it sounded like Kiyosaki. Okay. And so there have been many times where people come up to me and they say, your book changed my life. I was lost. I didn't know what to do. I needed direction. So I read your book and I want to thank you because it changed my life. And I say to them, well, which book? Because I've written 16 books. And they say, oh, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which was written by Robert Kiyosaki, not Guy Kawasaki. So that's happened a lot.
I suspected that you may be experiencing an issue with that. I remember when you guys reached out to us to be on the podcast, that was a thought I had. So totally. So let's dive in. Well, you've had such an incredible career so far, and you're still doing so many important things right now. Maybe you could take us through your journey briefly.
I could take you through my journey very briefly. I was born and raised in Honolulu, Hawaii, lower middle class family. Because of a sixth grade teacher convinced my parents to put me into private school, I eventually got into Stanford. From Stanford, I started my love affair with high tech after a brief experience with law school. And then I got an MBA. I worked in the jewelry business. And finally, I switched to tech and I worked at Apple as Apple's second software evangelist. I've started companies. I've been an author and a speaker. I returned to Apple as Apple's chief evangelist. And now I am chief evangelist of Canva. I am the host of the Remarkable People podcast. And I am the co-author of Think Remarkable. And I also surf a lot.
So not many people will be familiar with what is chief evangelist. Could you let us know what it is?
Yes. The word evangelism comes from Greek roots, which means bringing the good news. So what an evangelist does is bring the good news. You could say that Jesus brought the good news of eternal life. And then there was 2,000 years. And then the Apple Macintosh evangelists, we brought the good news of Macintosh that would increase people's creativity and productivity. And then fast forward again. The chief evangelist of Canva is in the function of bringing the good news of Canva, that Canva will make you a better communicator because it enables you to design beautiful graphics.
So you worked at Apple. I feel we need to spend a lot of time there because I'm sure you have many incredible stories that only you can tell. Where should we start?
Well, we could start with how did I go from the jewelry business to Apple? How did I go from low tech to high tech? And this is an important lesson. I got into Apple because of nepotism. That is, my friend hired me. On paper, there wasn't LinkedIn back then, but if there was, and if you saw my profile and you were a recruiter for the Macintosh division, you would not have hired me or even interviewed me. I did not have the right college education nor the right work experience. And it was purely because my friend in college hired me into Apple. So there's several lessons there. One lesson is be nice to people in Apple because someday you may need to be hired by them. A second lesson is that it's not how you get into a company. It's what you do after you get in. So if you took the opposite case where let's suppose that I had a Harvard undergraduate degree, had a computer science PhD, all that's wonderful. It'll probably help you get hired by a tech company. But about a day after you start, those degrees don't mean anything. And you cannot live off those past accomplishments. It's what kind of results you bring.
Very true. So once you joined, what were your responsibilities?
My responsibility was to convince Macintosh, or it was actually any kind of developer, software developer, to create a Macintosh version of their product. So we would work with companies like Microsoft and Lotus and Ashton Tate and WordPerfect, many of which people may not even remember anymore. And we also work with hardware and peripheral manufacturers. Because a personal computer without software and peripherals is pretty useless. So our job, it would be like you have a TV, but there's no shows to watch. So our job was to make sure there's a lot of shows to watch.
Do you remember the day when you met Steve Jobs?
This is another great story. So I don't know if it was the day I met him, but when I was being hired into Apple, my friend, Mike Boych, the guy who hired me, you know, the nepotism. After I had interviewed with people in the division, and including Steve, Mike Boych goes to Steve and says, "Well, what do you think about Guy?" And Steve said to him, "Well, he's okay, but I just want you to know, if he screws up, I'm going to fire you too." So that was the positive feedback, ringing endorsement I got for working at Apple.
Maybe you can take us through your journey with Apple, how things unfolded for you once you started.
Yeah. So I started in 1983 working with software and hardware companies. Macintosh was introduced about 4 months later, 1984, January. So it's the 40th anniversary. And after initial just revelation, like such positivity, everybody's so excited. You know, at some point, all the pioneers and the early adopters and the risk takers, they were gone. I mean, you know, you already had them. And this is how Jeffrey Moores explains, you know, this innovation adoption curve, that you can get pioneers and the nutcases to buy almost anything. But then you have this big gap. And lots of companies fall into this gap and never get over to the other side, which is Main Street, when many people buy computers or buy your new product. So after a few years, you know, we definitely hit the wall, and that's when there were layoffs and Steve got fired and, you know, they hired John Sculley and Gil Amelio and all this kind of stuff happened. And after all that happened, I returned to Apple after having left, and I came back as a chief evangelist, and my job was to preserve the Macintosh cult. To keep people believing in Macintosh.
What were your relationship like with Steve, if we can discuss that?
Yeah, well, I would not say that I was in his inner circle and, you know, one of his best friends and confidants. Probably every story you've heard about Steve is true, that he was a difficult person to work for, scary. And those two things are true, but I will tell you, I consider it an honor and a privilege to have worked for him. I don't think I would be where I am were it not for Steve Jobs. I cherish the days that I worked there. And yet, you know, it was a very scary experience because He just did not tolerate anything but great results, and he would make it very clear when he was not happy. So that's kind of contrary to every modern HR and management theory. He scared the shit out of me.
Could you share some stories with us?
Oh, okay. So this is a great insight into Steve Jobs and what it was like. Basically, your reputation was on the line every day. So one day, I'm in my cubicle and I'm working, and he shows up with somebody I had never met. I had no idea who this person was. And he asked me, what do you think of this product called Nowhere and their educational software? I say, Steve, the educational software they make is not that impressive. It's drill in practice, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 kind of, you know, card-based thing. So it's not that big a deal, not that crucial for us. And then he turns to me and he says, you know, guy, this is the CEO of that company. So he had totally set me up. And now, I mean, there's many ways to interpret this, but the proper way to interpret this is that Steve probably also thought that that company's products were crap. And what he was basically checking me out, because if I had said those products are great and he knew they were crap, I literally could have been fired on the spot. It could have happened. So luckily I passed the test that day, and I guess I learned a lesson, which is you better always tell the truth.
Very true. And be informed and be good at your job. Take it seriously.
Yeah, well, that helps too, yes.
You mentioned that Steve helped you become the person you are today, be as successful as you are. Maybe you could share with us some other ways that it helped you.
Sure. To become. So I think I learned an appreciation from Steve, ironically, of things Japanese, because he loved the Japanese sort of aesthetics. The simplicity, the elegance, you know, it's not like the Palace of Versailles, right? It's a very different kind of aesthetic. So I learned that less is more. I learned that you have to get people to believe in what you do, not simply buy your product. And people believed in Macintosh. They didn't just buy a Macintosh. I also learned from him that when people believe in what you do, they want to help you. And you should be gracious and accept that help, because it's a very powerful force. So there were many people who were Macintosh evangelists who didn't work for Apple. They did it purely out of love.
Another question I have to ask you, given that you had this rare opportunity to work with Steve Jobs, I feel I have to ask you, what do you feel was the maybe most important reason why he became such an icon for so many people?
Well, I think Steve had a one in, I don't know, a billion ability to understand what people would come to want to have. And so, you know, he could go to Xerox PARC and see things that he could translate into future things. And he could anticipate why people would want the graphical user interface. And then he could get people to believe in having that graphical user interface as much as he did. So in a sense, he was clairvoyant. And like a lot of people like to use the word visionary about themselves, and I think a visionary comes along once every 10 or 15 years. And all these people who claim to be visionaries, they're just using the word. They have no idea. Steve Jobs, even Elon Musk, they're in a class by themselves.
If someone would want to develop that quality within themselves, what would be your advice?
First of all, I think it would be foolish to say that I want to be as visionary as Steve Jobs, because that's a very high bar. I mean, I'm not against high bars, but, you know, I think the more remarkable thing to do is, like, forget about trying to become an icon or a thought leader or a visionary. Just make great stuff. And if you make great stuff, people will label you as a remarkable visionary, thought leader, whatever. But it's not because you decided to position yourself that way. It's because you actually did great stuff. So the hard part and the valuable part is to do great stuff, not to worry about what people think about you.
100% agree with you. And my question was for someone who wants to do great stuff, not someone who wants
Okay. You're right. Sorry. So if you want to do great stuff, I give you several methods because there is no single path. So method number one is simply make what you want to use and then hope that you're not the only nutcase that wants to use it. And I would make that case that describes Steve Wozniak. He was building the Apple One that he wanted to use. So that's method number one, make what you want to use. Method number two is to work backwards from the customer. That is, instead of working forward from what you like to do, what you're good at doing, what you have been doing, you work backwards and you figure out what people need and then you work forward to fill that need. So it's not what you like to do, it's what they need. Another method is to go and see what problems people are encountering. And I would say even better than going and seeing would be going and being the person. So let's use an analogy like cars. And before there were minivans, you know, when Chrysler came out the first minivan, if you were a car manufacturer, it would have been useful to go and see how people are using minivans. But even better, it would be better if you actually bought a minivan. And you would understand that, you know, if you're a couple with two kids, two baby bags, two strollers, and two car seats, that's what it's like to have kids. So you're not watching people with kids. You're actually a person with kids, and you would truly understand why a minivan is so useful.
Makes total sense. What are some of the interactions that you had with Steve that really helped you grow, apart from the one that you already shared? Maybe you could share a couple more examples.
Well,
opportunity to speak to someone who personally worked with Steve Jobs.
Well, first of all, I think it would be an overstatement to say that I personally work with Steve Jobs. You know, I was one level removed, and I consider maybe that was a good fortune, because sometimes working too close to the sun, you get burned. But those interactions, you know, I saw him just shred some people. And that sounds like a negative, but it was a positive factor for me. It motivated me to avoid being shredded. And I saw his demands on people. I also, this is back in the mid-80s. And in the mid-80s, if you looked at Steve's direct reports, half of them are women. And this is way before the Me Too movement and way before the concept of glass ceiling and all that. And what I learned that Steve Jobs, he didn't care about your race, your creed, your color, your sexual orientation, your religion, any of that. All he cared about was that you were great and you could do great things. And for everything else, I don't think he cared. And that's a valuable lesson too.
Do you feel that it shifted your internal value system versus just things that are more on the surface?
I fundamentally think he changed my value system in terms of valuing simplicity and design, without question. And it's kind of ironic. I'm Japanese and I learned these Japanese values from Steve Jobs.
Beautiful. Are there things that you think people should know about Steve, you would like people to know about Steve, that you could share that people don't know?
I think, you know, so much has been written about Steve and all that. And like I said, it's not like I was his best friend hanging around him 24/7, but these are the lessons that I have. And there are many books about him, but I just caution people that, you know, with people like Steve or Elon Musk or Bill Gates, I mean, really, any really visibly successful person, you need to be very careful about separating causation and correlation. And in particular with Steve, you know, a lot of people think, oh, Steve Jobs was a very difficult person. He scared everybody. He wore blue jeans, New Balance shoes, black mock turtleneck. He would get a car but not license it because he didn't like how the license plates look. So he would change car every 6 months. And you know, he would park his car in the handicap slot even though he wasn't handicapped. And he would drive in the carpool lane even though it was only him in the car and blah, blah, blah. And people look at all these externalities and they think, oh, I'm going to be like Steve Jobs. I'm going to be innovative and visionary, and I'm going to be, you know, changing the world and famous and all that. So I'm going to go buy a black mock turtleneck and jeans and New Balance shoes and a Mercedes and a Porsche and park in the handicap slot and drive in the carpool lane. And that's going to make me Steve Jobs. And I tell you, it takes a lot more than that.
100%. And I think that is the point of our discussion today. I'm trying to get for our listeners some insights on things that actually mean something in terms of how they can be more impactful leaders themselves. Definitely not about any superficial things like that.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, if you want to read about how to be more impactful, Think Remarkable is the book for you. So, you know, you have to understand that I have this podcast that I interview 52 remarkable people a year. And this includes people like Jane Goodall or, you know, like Steve Wozniak or Neil deGrasse Tyson or Steve Wolfram. I have MacArthur Award winners and all these things. And so I have 200 of these interviews in my head. And those 200 interviews, if you listen to them, would take 200 hours and you'd have to read 4,000 pages of transcripts. So what we did, my co-author and I, is we took 4,000 pages down to 170 because we wanted to find just like the most powerful ways to make a difference and to change the world. And so if your listeners are looking for ways to be more impactful, I'm telling you, this is the book. This is the book for you.
Maybe you could share with us top three that really stood out for you out of all those interviews.
I have three general ways. The book is divided into three parts: growth, grit, and grace. And those are the three. So growth means that if you want to make a difference and be remarkable, you have to accept that you need to grow. You need to gain new skills, new perspectives. You need to grow. You cannot stay static. Grit means that even if you're trying to grow, growing is not easy. You have to have grit. You have to have perseverance. You need to feel vulnerable, risk failure, and recover from failure. And the final thing is grace, because I think truly remarkable people at the end of their careers, they have decided that what they want to be remembered for is how they made the world a better place and how they paid back society. And so that's the three principles. You got to grow, you got to work hard, and then you got to pay back.
For some of our listeners now, they are already very successful in their careers, but they still don't feel that they are doing something that they feel this huge passion towards, the way Steve felt towards his work, the way you feel towards your work. What would be your recommendation based on interviewing so many people and based on your own experience and work journey? What would be some of the advice you would give?
Listen, one of the people I interview and put in the back of the book is a guy named Daniel Pink. And he did what's called the Regrets Project. And so he surveyed tens of thousands of people around the world about what were their biggest regrets. And the two biggest regrets were not taking a chance, not risking more, and, you know, starting that company, becoming an artist, you know, going outside the box. And the other big regret is not maintaining their family and social relationships, that they let those fall by the side. I think that's very good data for people. Well, you know, your journey, and it's more likely that you're going to regret not taking a risk than it's going to be that you took a risk and it failed. So that's just good to know that, you know, you should take risks.
100% agree. So let's say it is someone, they're hearing you right now, they want to take risks, but they don't know which way to go. Let's say they are senior manager or even more senior within a large organization, but they don't really feel connected to what they're doing. They want to find something that is their true calling. That's something that they really feel fired up to do.
Well, I would tell you that don't set yourself up for failure and excessive expectations. That, you know, there's this line of reasoning that you should find your true calling and your passion in life. And if you haven't, something's wrong with you. And that sets you up for failure because you think you're going to find this one thing and it's just going to knock you off your feet and you're going to just focus on that the rest of your life. My experience is that life presents you with lots of interesting things. It may be interesting to be a writer, to be a podcaster, to be a painter, to be a surfer, to be an artist, to be a musician, to make movies. And, you know, it wasn't like one day you just got overwhelmed and fell in love and left and joined the circus. I think that you have to scratch a lot of itches. You have to do a lot of sampling. And over the course of your lifetime, you know, maybe some of these itches that you scratch become passions. But to do that, it's the law of big numbers. You've got to scratch a lot of itches as opposed to, you know, just blinders on. Now, there's some people who just stick with one thing. I'm not saying that that's bad, but I'm telling you that you should have your eyes wide open because there's a lot of interesting things in this world. And so force yourself out of that box, you know, like take classes, pursue hobbies, meet people who are diverse. That's not the same gender, color, race, religion, you know, sexual orientation as you. You need to get a lot of data.
For yourself, as you were going through your career, do you feel it was easy for you to find what you want to do next?
I think that it was. Listen, I've been about five things in my career, and I'm 69 years old. And it's not like I went hunting for them. I think they just, good fortune brought them to me. But I was fortunate to have enough of an open mind to consider different things. You know, I went from jewelry to Macintosh and then Macintosh to software to social media. Well, there was the internet in there too. And then I got into podcasting and then graphic design with Canva and all the way along, I was writing. I was never trained as a writer. I don't have a PhD in English. And so I had a lot of interest and I scratched a lot of things and I came up with five or six that I really loved.
And when you look back at your career, can you see the dots connect backwards?
Yes, absolutely. And Steve Jobs made a commencement address where that was his main point, that you can only connect the dots looking backwards. So, you know, in a sense, give yourself a break. You know, you can't thread the needle. That I quit law school. At the time, I thought that was the end of the world. Turns out it was one of the best things ever. And I happened to make friends with somebody at Stanford because he liked cars and I like cars. And luckily, he was rich enough to have them and I wasn't. But because of that friendship, a few years later, he hired me into Apple. It's not like I was in college and I said, you know what? I'm going to fall in love with cars so I can meet rich people who can give me a job later. I mean, it was never a plan.
Could you share with us some of the habits that you believe helped you be successful?
Well, I think that I have one primary habit, which is a love to work. There are people who are smarter than me. There are people who are harder working than me, but there are not too many people who can do both. I really love to work. I grit. I don't consider it a chore, even today. Listen, my podcast has no economic model. I don't sell sponsorships. I don't sell ads. It costs a lot for me to do my podcast because I have very high standards for the editing and the marketing of it. And you would be shocked how much it costs for me to do my podcast. But everybody has, you know, their weaknesses, and my weakness is podcasting.
Totally understand what you mean. We have been strategy skills for, we started way before it was cool to have a podcast, and we never had an advertiser paying for placement. We have a lot of requests, but we don't take them. And I can totally understand the amount of work that went into it over so many years. And it's an important work that we do. So you mentioned that you love working, and I totally can resonate with that because I'm myself like that. Do you feel that there are certain things that allow you to be effective with the way you spend your time? Because you can work very hard and get very little done.
I don't know what to say. I work very hard and I get a lot done. I'm a driven person. And listen, I'm 69. Many people retire at 65. I work now as hard as I've ever worked. And it's just in me. It's just, that's my DNA. I don't want to sit around and watch TV all day. I don't want to play golf. Although I got to tell you, I surf almost every day. So that's 2 or 3 hours. But I'm just a driven person.
You interviewed 200 guests. Some of those guests, it's very difficult for them to agree to be on a podcast. So maybe you could share with us some ideas on how can someone build the relationships with amazing leaders, because that is
one. Okay, sure.
As a leader.
So number one is that I've been very fortunate that I became very well known because of my work with Macintosh. And it's also true that many remarkable people use Macintoshes. And so when many of the people you want to interview use the computer that you help make successful, that's very helpful because they know of me as opposed to know me. So many people who I have never met say, oh, I've heard about your work. I followed you for years because I use a Macintosh. So I have an unfair advantage there. And I'll tell you a story about connecting the dots. So in the sixth grade, my teacher in his public school in Hawaii convinced my parents to take me out of the public school system and put me into the college prep system. Luckily, my parents listened, and luckily they made the sacrifice. So I got into this college prep school. That college prep school enabled me to get into Stanford. At Stanford, I met Mike Boych. Mike Boych later hired me into Apple as the Macintosh evangelist. So now I'm working in Apple, and I'm getting to be well known because of my work with Macintosh. Fast forward about 20 years, and I get this email out of the blue from someone running TEDx Palo Alto. And she says, I know of you, Guy, because I'm a Macintosh user. I have Jane Goodall coming to do a TEDx in Palo Alto. I need somebody to interview her. Would you like to be that person? And of course I said yes, right? And so I interviewed Jane Goodall and we became friends. She wrote the foreword for this book. And so, connecting the dots, if that sixth grade teacher had not talked to my parents, if my parents had not listened to her, if I had not gone to that school, if I had not applied to Stanford, if I had not met Mike Boych, if I had not worked in the Macintosh division, then this person at TEDx would not have heard of me and I would not have gotten to Jane Goodall and become friends. Now, when Jane Goodall becomes your friend and you start a podcast, the first person I thought of was, who could be a better first guest than Jane Goodall of all people? That's like, that's a home run, to use a sports analogy. That's a field goal in overtime that wins the Super Bowl. And so I had Jane Goodall. Now, I'll tell you, as a podcast guest, the first thing that I think of when somebody asks me to be on their podcast is, who else have you had on your podcast? And if they tell me, a bunch of names that I have not heard of or people that I just don't affiliate with high quality, I say no. But if somebody said, if I said to somebody, who else has been on your podcast? And they said, well, we've had Jane Goodall, Stacey Abrams, Angela Duckworth, Steve Wolfram, Steve Wozniak, Margaret Atwood, Vivek Murthy. I mean, at that point you say, holy shit, it's an honor to be on this podcast. Now, that's not going to work with Michelle Obama or Barack Obama, but for 99% of the people you'd ever want on your podcast, when you tell them your list of guests, there's no doubt that you have a good podcast.
That is very true. So that first guest helped you to get the second guest and so on.
Exactly. So because the way I told Margaret Atwood, I had Jane Goodall. And then I told the next person, I had Margaret Atwood and Jane Goodall. And it just gets better after that. And like right now, we turn down about 10 people a day who want to be on this podcast. So let's say we turn down 2,500 people a year. We take 50. So the odds are 1 out of 50 that you get on my podcast. So it's easier to get into Stanford or Harvard than on my podcast.
I totally understand what you mean. We receive a lot of requests every day as well. And I feel bad because everyone has a story. Everyone has something to teach. But of course,
I'm honored to be on your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much. As you were going through your career, were there a person, a mentor, or maybe there were a few key mentors that really helped you? So we spoke about Steve a lot, but you mentioned that you did not work with him directly. Was there someone who you worked with directly who helped you make good decisions along the way?
Let me set the record straight. I would not say that Steve Jobs was my mentor. Okay, I did not have that kind of relationship with him. Now, believe it or not, one of the people who really helped me in my career was in the jewelry business. And the president of that company's name is Marty Gruber. Basically, he took somebody who wasn't in his family, no background in jewelry, and he enabled me to do a lot of sales and marketing. So he took me under his wing. He taught me sales and marketing and he trusted me. And, the jewelry business involves a lot of trust because you can walk out of a company in the jewelry business with a lot in your pocket. Okay. And he trusted me and he really helped me learn how to sell. And that has been a valuable skill for the rest of my life.
How did you use that skill?
Selling is selling at some level. And whether it's jewelry or a Macintosh or a graphic design program or selling people on being on your podcast, at some level, sales is sales. And I think I had such a good foundation for sales because I learned in one of the toughest circumstances, which is selling jewelry sales. And we were a manufacturer. So we sold to retailers. We didn't sell the actual user of the jewelry. But the buyers in the retail jewelry business are very tough people. So you really learn how to sell.
I think that everyone now very curious. What did you learn about sailing while working with that person that became your mentor? I know we don't have much time, but maybe you could share a few
words. I think, you know, the key to sailing, one key is simply patience and perseverance, because you really learn that you're going to be waiting in lobbies and offices for the appointment, and they're going to be running late, and then they're going to cut you short. And after spending an hour or two with you, they're not going to order anything. And so you really learn to put up with that kind of stuff and to just keep going. Another is that I think in order for people to become good customers, they have to learn to trust you. And trust is a key component of sales. And the jewelry business truly is built on trust, because, you know, the commodity is so valuable. And if you took, for example, gold jewelry, when you say your gold jewelry is 18 carats or 14 carats, you know, not a lot of people are actually going to take a sample and have it assay to determine it's really 18K or 14K. They're going to trust you. But if you ever screw that up, they will never trust you again. And this is, I think it's basically true of all sales. Sales is about trust.
That is very true, 100%. And I think it also comes with your own intention of doing right by people, doing what's best for them.
And which is like evangelism, right? Like, it's not only good for me, it's good for you.
Very true. What were some aha moments, realizations in the last few years that changed the way you look at life or the way you look at business?
Oh, I don't know. In the last few years, I haven't had very many aha moments. I've just been podcasting and, you know, working and writing, and don't get me wrong, there are many, many absolutely remarkable moments in our podcast where I heard stories I would never have heard before. And so that's been remarkable. I'll tell you one. So I met an artist named Haleem Flowers for my podcast. And if you're familiar with art, think of Jean-Michel Basquiat. So he may be the next Jean-Michel Basquiat. And I'm listening to his story, and he was, at age 16, he was put in jail for, I think, 44 years. He served 22 years and then was released. And then rather than going back into jail, he made a life as being an artist. And he's one of the hottest artists in America today. And I've spent days with him, and he's not like this angry, bitter person. He's just changed his life. He's taken this, and, you know, he's really made himself into a remarkable person. And you know, that kind of story is very, very inspiring.
Do you feel that it changed something in the way you look at life?
Well, I mean, for sure, one of the things that it changes you when you hear that kind of story is you come to grips with how fortunate you are, because I did not spend 22 years in prison, right? I mean, you can't look back on this and say, oh, that was a great experience. I'm so glad I went through that. So, you know, how people can overcome stuff like that. I've had people on my podcast where both parents were crack addicts and they were stealing all the money from the kids. And, you know, to hear what people go through, it makes you more humble and more appreciative of your life.
Very true. Guy, thank you very much.
It was You're very welcome.
With us. How can our listeners learn more about you, your work, where they can buy your book, anything you want to share?
Well, you should be able to buy my book anywhere in the world. And distribution is like that. It's called Think Remarkable, and it will help you make a difference and be remarkable. My website is guykawasaki.com, and that makes perfect sense. So there you go.
Thank you very much.
All right. I hope everybody enjoys growth, grit, and grace, and makes a difference.
Thank you very much again, Guy. Really amazing to
All the best to you. Thank you.
For sharing all the stories. And for everyone listening, our podcast sponsor today is strategytraining.com. If you want to strengthen your strategy skills, you can get the overall approach used in well-managed strategy studies. It is a free download. Go to firmsconsulting.com/overall approach. And if you're preparing for your interviews right now, you want to get another role, you can get our McKinsey & BCG winning resume that got offers from both McKinsey & BCG. It is free download. Go to firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF. And we discussed today that we don't have advertisements, external advertisements. That is our internal advertisement. Well, it is basically my company sponsoring my ability to be here and speaking to you guys and interviewing amazing guests like Guy. Thank you, everyone, again. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you, Guy, for being with us. And I'm looking forward to connect with you all very soon.